So thank you for waiting. The line should be a little quieter now. I would like to welcome everyone to today's CHE Fertility Call, titled Effects of BPA on In Vitro Fertilization. Our moderator today is Karen Russ, the National Coordinator for CHE Fertility. We have set up a blog in association with today's call, and you can post comments or questions there, and we will do our best to get to all of them. To get to the blog, you go to the CHE homepage at healthandenvironment.org. Select the call link from the left-hand box, and then you can follow that link to the blog. All of our speakers have also submitted slides to accompany their presentations, and so if you're at your computer, you can find them on the call page by, again, going to the CHE website, selecting that link from the left-hand box, and then selecting background information and resources from the next page. Everyone on the call right now has been muted with the exception of our speakers and our moderator. At the end of the conversation, we will go ahead and open things up for a Q&A session. The call is scheduled to last for an hour. It is being recorded, and an MP3 file will be available for downloading on the CHE website soon. And with that, we hope you enjoy the call. And Karen, I'll turn off those entry and exit chimes for
us. Thank you. I appreciate that, Erica.
Turn it over to you.
Yes, great. Well, welcome, everyone. I'm so glad that you're able to join us on this call. I'm very excited today to have three experts in the field of human reproduction. I'd like to just give you a very short background and biography on each speaker. First, as many of you will know, bisphenol A, or BPA, is a synthetic chemical that's added to plastics to improve their performance. When it's taken into the body, however, it's an endocrine disrupting compound, and it mimics the effects of estrogen. There have been many studies done in animals, and more recently some human data have been collected that make a connection between BPA exposure and poor outcomes for in vitro fertilization. So today on the call, we have Dr. Fujimoto from UCSF, Dr. Michael Bloom from SUNY Albany, and they're going to be discussing the results of their recent study on the effects of BPA and in vitro fertilization. And then we are very lucky also to have Dr. Valerie Baker from Stanford University to lead a discussion of how research results like this can be translated into practice and what are some practical implications for patient counseling. So let me give you a little background about each of our presenters. Dr. Victor Fujimoto is a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences and the director of the in vitro fertilization program at UCSF. His areas of expertise include in vitro fertilization technologies and the development of non-invasive techniques for gynecological treatment. Dr. Fujimoto's research interests include IVF, environment and reproductive outcomes, oxidative stress markers and reproductive outcomes, peroxynase and reproduction, and follicular fluid studies. Dr. Fujimoto will be giving us some background on past studies of BPA and reproduction. And we also have Dr. Michael Bloom, who is located at University of Albany School of Public Health and the State University of New York in Albany. AU is in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and Epidemiology and Biostatistics. His research interests include the effects of environmental pollutants on human endocrine function, fecundity, and fertility, oxidative stress, and the role that environmental pollutants may have on assisted reproductive technologies are also areas of interest. Dr. Bloom will present findings of recently published studies that he and Dr. Fujimoto have been involved in, and also talk about some ongoing studies that they're doing on BPA and IVF. And also we have Dr. Valerie Baker. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University and the medical director of the Stanford Fertility and Reproductive Medicine Center. She sits as the director of Stanford's Primary Ovarian Insufficiency Program and is also on the board of directors at the Society for Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility. Dr. Baker's clinical specialties include reproductive endocrinology and infertility, primary ovarian insufficiency, and assisted reproductive technologies. Dr. Baker, again, will be describing how she counsels patients who are undergoing assisted reproduction and ways to avoid BPA. So thank you all once again for coming, and I'd like to start off with Dr. Fujimoto. Welcome again. Victor, I think you're there on the line.
Perhaps you called in under the wrong...
Oh.
Do we have our other speakers?
I'm here. I hear you guys.
Okay.
So this is Valerie.
So Dr. Fujimoto, if you can hear us, you can press star 6 and see if that will unmute you.
Hmm.
I wonder what happened.
Yes, possibly he got disconnected, but we'll be calling back in.
Is there...
Another option might be if you wanted to unmute all the callers and maybe he would speak
sure,
up.
Sure, let me see what I can do here. 1 second, everybody. Apologies.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I should be able to hear everyone now. Is Dr. Fujimoto there?
Well, somehow we've lost him, but perhaps we should go ahead and continue on with Michael Bloom.
Okay, I'm going to move everybody back into the presentation mode real quick.
Okay.
Okay, great. I'll get started then. Thank you very much, everybody, for your time, and Drs. Fujimoto and Baker for joining me in this teleconference, and especially Erica and Karen for arranging this event. Please move to the second slide in the presentation. Couples employing assisted reproductive technologies are subject to intense collection and follow-up of data spanning the interval between follicular genesis
Hello?
And the first trimester
Hello?
Of gestation.
Hi, Vic. I'm
sorry.
Hello.
I don't know what's going on, guys. I ended up dialing I must have not dialed the speaker access code.
Ah.
All right, Vic, well, do you want to, can we
Why don't I
start?
If you don't mind, I'll start since mine is a lead into yours.
Great.
Sorry about that, guys. I'm
That's
just,
okay.
I've never,
glad
obviously,
to
I've never done this before with the speaker access code process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
That's fine. We're so glad
okay.
that you're on the line.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Okay, so do you have my presentation up?
So yes, the presentations are all available online, and those who have computer access can have them up, and then if you can kind of be somewhat descriptive for those people who may not be sitting at their computers today.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go off of my presentation PowerPoint.
Okay.
To go. So the title of my presentation is Bisphenol A and Reproduction, and as we were designing the presentation today, Dr. Bloom and I, we made the decision that I would present on what we know so far about bisphenol A and human reproduction and provide the information that has been published thus far, and that presentation would act as a lead-in into the studies that Dr. Bloom and I have been conducting. So the second slide, the next slide, is periconceptual exposures. Development begins at fertilization. And this is really to illustrate the fact that environmental contaminants, BPA being one example, have potentially the ability to influence and modify the events that occur immediately after ovulation and during the growth and development of the oocyte to points beyond, which includes fertilization and the establishment of an embryo and the subsequent cleavage and development of the embryo to the final stage of blastocyst prior to implantation. Next slide. We know that BPA is ubiquitous. We know that it has many different sources by which exposures can occur, and I've listed on this slide some of them that with a primary focus on dietary intake, that plastic bottle exposures, what has been in the media with regard to baby bottles, various metal and cardboard-based food and beverage cans, and cardboard cartons are all potentially exposure risks in terms of BPA. We know that BPA is found clearly in the environment within air, dust, and water, and we know that dental sealants also lend themselves to potential BPA exposure. And more recently, there's been an acknowledgement from studies that clearly show that thermal receipts and money can have residual BPA contamination. So all of these various exposures really indicate to us that a large proportion of the U.S. population is at risk for exposure to BPA. So that sets the stage for some of the background that we that got Dr. Bloom and I very interested in studying BPA from a periconceptual standpoint, and the sentinel studies that began to demonstrate an effect on reproduction date back to beginning of this decade, in around 2000, 2001. In 2003, it was Dr. Patricia Hunt, who is now at Washington State University, who was formerly at Case Western Reserve, who first demonstrated serendipitously that BPA exposure causes meiotic aneuploidy in the female mouse. This is the next slide. In the course of her experiments of and studying meiotic events in mouse oocytes back in 1998 on a very hot summer in Cleveland, she noticed this dramatic and sudden increase in eggs that exhibited gross disturbances in chromosomal alignment, a term that she called a congressional failure, but basically a problem with the development of the meiotic spindle. Okay. We know that typically 1 to 2% of the eggs exhibit this problem in mice. Sorry, I'm trying to get over a cold. In experiments conducted, though, in 1998, she noticed this dramatic rise. The next slide shows an example of what she saw. And you can see the disruption in slide B and D versus the normal configuration in A. Subsequently, studies done in Japan demonstrated that BPA was found in many fluids, including follicular fluid, amniotic fluid, both in early pregnancy and late pregnancy, and those that study was published by Ikazuki et al., which is the next slide. Now, particularly concerning with this particular slide is that the amniotic fluid happens to have a much higher concentration of BPA, especially in early pregnancy. But nonetheless, from our perspective, the presence of BPA in follicular fluid was something that prompted us to begin to think about whether BPA in the human could potentially be influencing the quality of eggs demonstrated by Pat Hunt with meiotic failure. Next slide. Given this observation of meiotic problems, a study was published by Ogawa Sawa, again from Japan, that attempted to demonstrate a relationship between BPA exposure and recurrent pregnancy loss. We know that spontaneous miscarriages in women who are attempting to get pregnant are, for the most part, directly related to problems associated with eggs, and that the that a condition called aneuploidy, which is an abnormal number of chromosomes, most exemplified by Down syndrome, is are primary reasons for why miscarriages occur in an aging population of women. With that as a backdrop, this particular study attempted to show an association between bisphenol A levels in patients who had miscarriages, who had prior history of multiple miscarriages, and patients who did not. And so that ultimately prompted the publication of this study and further controversy around what BPA was potentially doing to women from the standpoint of their reproductive efficiency. Now, a couple things about this particular study. The way in which BPA was measured, it was measured by an enzyme-linked immunoassay, which to this day remains controversial in terms of its accuracy, in terms of actual measuring of BPA. The other thing about this study is these blood measurements that were measured were not necessarily consistent in terms of when the blood was taken relative to the miscarriage and relative to the history of miscarriages. So there are some variables that may clearly influence the actual endpoint and association. That said, this was the first study to begin to examine the relationship between BPA and recurrent miscarriage. And the next slide really is a graph that represents the fact that they saw overall much higher BPA levels measured as nanograms per ml in patients who miscarried with abnormal embryo karyotypes. I just highlighted it with a red with a red bar. So the most recent study that I wanted to quote and summarize for you is the study published from the Harvard Public School of Health that was published in 2010 that looked at BPA exposure and the number of oocytes retrieved during IVF. Using statistical modeling, this team of investigators found that BPA, urinary BPA concentrations were associated with the number of oocytes, inversely associated with the number of oocytes retrieved after adjusting for age, BMI, and day 3 FSH levels. Okay. A recent study by Dr. Linda Judice and her colleagues, demonstrated that in addition to potential effects on the eggs, BPA may in fact be having potential effects on various production of hormones from ovarian follicles during their development. And this BPA and study, which was an in vitro study, looked at a human granulosa cell line. Granulosa cells are cells that are part of the ovarian follicle that produce estrogens, and aromatase is the enzyme that converts testosterone to estrogen. And what they showed was that as you increase the exposure of these estrogen-producing cells in vitro to BPA while you're stimulating them with FSH, or follicle-stimulating hormone, we see this reduction in estradiol production. As we further discuss, as we further discuss this study, we see that that they were able to show that as you increase the BPA exposure, they saw a reduction in the expression of aromatase enzyme CYP19, and they further demonstrated that the effect of BPA on reducing aromatase activity was acting via PPAR gamma receptors. A signaling molecule. So on to the next slide. These background studies prompted Dr. Bloom and I to incorporate BPA as an environmental contaminant of interest into our SMART study. SMART We named the study SMART for study of heavy metals and assisted reproductive technologies, but that initial interest in heavy metals has evolved into incorporation of organic compounds that now include BPA as well. How am I doing on time?
You're just about right, I think, because you're finishing up, right?
Okay. So that's my talk, and this is really a lead-in for Dr. Bloom to present our findings in our IVF model.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate that nice overview of the science in the last few years. And Dr. Bloom, you're going to be talking about what you and your colleagues have done more recently, right?
Correct. Great. Thank you very much, Vic. For those folks that have access to the slide presentation, please turn to slide number 2. The SMART, as introduced by Dr. Fujimoto, is a pilot study designed to generate specific testable hypotheses concerning associations between background exposures to environmental risk factors and IVF endpoints. Women and their male partners undergoing a first IVF procedure at the Center for Reproductive Health at the University of California at San Francisco were eligible to participate. Please move to slide number 3. Excuse me. The flowchart on slide 3 describes the SMART study protocol, which you'll note overlaps substantially with a standard clinical IVF protocol. The pink and blue rectangles indicate clinical procedures for women and men, respectively. Ovals indicate biologic specimens collected from SMART participants, and triangles represent various study endpoints. Following referral to the IVF clinic, our research assistant approached and described the study to potential participants or couples. Informed consent was obtained during the pre-cycle preparation time period. Patients and their partners received baseline infertility evaluations, including gynecologic and reproductive histories, medical history, and completed a questionnaire designed to capture health-related behaviors. Women underwent gonadotropin-induced ovarian follicle stimulation according to clinic protocols. When a sufficient number of follicles had matured, human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG, was administered subcutaneously and oocytes were collected approximately 36 hours later. On that day of oocyte collection, fasting whole blood and urine specimens were obtained from female patients and non-fasting samples from male partners when they were available. In addition, post-processing ovarian follicular fluid and seminal fluid was archived for patients and their partners. Using sperm collected from male partners or donors, collected mature oocytes were inseminated by intracytoplasmic sperm injection or by incubation with sperm. Approximately 16 to 18 hours following insemination, normally fertilized zygotes were identified by the appearance of two pronuclei. Embryos were transferred to patients 48 to 72 hours after fertilization, and urine pregnancy tests administered 2 weeks later. 2 weeks after that, ultrasound was used to confirm clinical pregnancy. Please move to slide 4. A total of 58 female patients and 37 male partners were recruited to the SMART study. Unconjugated bisphenol A was measured for 44 women and 32 partners by Fred von Saal's laboratory at the University of Missouri using high-performance liquid chromatography with cool array detection. Using a variety of statistical approaches, we considered several endpoints in association with female or female and male BPA concentrations, including follicle response to the gonadotropin stimulation protocol, oocyte fertilization, and embryo quality. These approaches involve consideration of the woman, the oocyte, or the embryo as the unit of observation and necessitated accommodation of correlated outcomes within couple for certain analyses. Please move to slide number 5. We observed little association between the concentrations of BPA measured in women and men participating in the SMART. The graph in slide 5 illustrates the relative independence of BPA measured in women, plotted on the y-axis, and their male partners, plotted on the x-axis. These results have not been published. The slope of the green, happy St. Patrick's Day, best fit line is quite mild. This line describes the relation between BPA in women and men. Adjustment for other factors of potential importance, including age, and race ethnicity, which we defined as Asian or not Asian, and cigarette smoking, which we defined as never or ever, did not alter this pattern in any substantial fashion. Also illustrated on the graph are the geometric mean BPA concentrations for women, denoted by the horizontal pink line, and for men, denoted by the vertical blue line. While BPA has a short half-life, we a priori anticipated a similar pattern of exposure among the members of couples, given a presumed pattern of related dietary habits, or perhaps even a higher concentration among the men due to reported associations between BPA metabolism and the androgens. Given the presumed importance of diet as the primary source of BPA exposure, it is interesting to note that the geometric mean concentrations for women in our study, 4.53 nanograms per milliliter of serum, is more than double that of their male partners, equal to 1.97 nanograms per milliliter of serum. As a reminder, women were required to fast to facilitate conscious sedation during the oocyte collection procedure, whereas men were not. Other recent literature also suggests the potential importance of non-dietary sources of BPA exposure. Please move to slide number 6. Using each woman as the unit of observation, we detect a decrease in the peak estrogen measured during gonadotropin stimulation in association with an increase in BPA concentration. The graph in slide 6 describes the peak concentration of estrogen measured on the y-axis as a function of BPA on the x-axis. These results are currently under review for publication. The peak estrogen value is an indicator of the ovarian follicle response to exogenous gonadotropin stimulation during the IVF protocol. The red and blue best fit lines describe relations in which increasing BPA is associated with decreases in estrogen assessed using two different approaches. Each of these is adjusted for additional variables of importance. Our results suggest an 11% decrease in the peak estrogen measured for each doubling in serum BPA concentration, illustrated by the broken red line. A similar association is detected when normalizing the peak measured estrogen concentration to the number of ovarian follicles which matured under gonadotropin stimulation, as illustrated by the solid blue line. These results suggest that BPA exposure in the female may interfere with estrogen synthesis in response to gonadotropin stimulation, and these results are similar to those recently reported by other investigators. Please move to slide number 7. Now using the oocyte as the unit of observation, we detect a decrease in the probability for an oocyte having matured to metaphase to arrest following administration of HCG with increasing concentrations of BPA. This association is, however, only detected for women reporting an Asian race ethnicity. The graph in slide 7 illustrates the probability for retrieval of a mature oocyte on the y-axis as a function of BPA among women receiving intracytoplasmic sperm injection on the x-axis. These results are currently in press. The graph is stratified in that the solid blue line of best fit describes the association for women not of Asian race ethnicity, and the broken red line describes the association for Asian women, each of which is adjusted for additional variables of importance. Our results suggest a 9% decrease in the probability for retrieval of a mature oocyte from Asian patients for each doubling of BPA concentration, as indicated by that broken red line. However, there is essentially no association between BPA and oocyte maturity among not Asian women, as illustrated by that solid blue line. These results suggest that BPA may interfere with the first meiotic division in response to HCG administration and are consistent with results in animals indicating congressional failure during meiosis. However, the race-ethnic specific nature of the result is intriguing. Please move to slide 8. Also using the oocyte as the unit of observation, we detect a reduction in the probability for normal oocyte fertilization in association with increases in the concentrations of BPA measured in both women and men. For males, this effect is specific to participants reporting an Asian race ethnicity. The table in slide 8 describes adjusted risk ratios for a statistical model in which female and male BPA, female and male age, female and male cigarette smoking, and female and male race ethnicity are simultaneously considered as predictors for normal oocyte fertilization. These results are currently in press. These results indicate that the probability for normal fertilization is reduced by 55% for each doubling of BPA in women. Moreover, a doubling of BPA in male partners is associated with a 12% decrease in the probability for fertilization, however, only among Asian men. Again, this detection of a race-ethnic-specific effect is quite intriguing. Please move to slide 9. Using the embryo as the unit of observation, we detect a decrease in the embryo cell number in association with an increase in BPA measured only in the male partners. A higher embryo cell number is generally associated with a greater probability for implantation. The graphs in slide 9 illustrate the probabilities for a higher embryo cell number on the y-axis as a function of BPA concentrations on the x-axis. These results are currently under review for publication. The blue and red best fit lines describe the associations between embryo cell number and BPA adjusted for partner BPA, age, and race ethnicity. The top graph indicates that BPA in women is not associated with cell number. The fairly flat blue and red lines underscore this independence. However, the bottom graph suggests that male BPA is associated with a decrease in cell number. In fact, a doubling of male BPA is associated with a 71% reduction in the probability that an embryo has a higher cell number. These novel results suggest that male BPA might interfere with early embryonic cleavage, perhaps due to epigenetic alterations or structural changes in BPA-exposed sperm. However, this explanation remains speculative at the time. Please move to slide 10. Overall, this preliminary study has generated several provocative results which we believe merit future investigation using a larger number of participants and a more comprehensive approach. To summarize, male BPA exposure may influence embryo quality among IVF couples even in the absence of a female effect. A doubling of female BPA is associated with a 50% reduction in the probability for a normally fertilized oocyte during IVF. Race ethnicity may be an important modifier of inverse associations between female BPA exposure and oocyte maturity during IVF. BPA may interfere with estradiol synthesis under gonadotropin stimulation during IVF. Also, non-dietary sources of BPA may be important contributors to human exposure in this infertile population. While these study results are compelling, the clinical relevance of this research remains to be determined and will be discussed further by Dr. Baker. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bloom. It was a wonderful presentation, and I appreciate the summary on the last slide. So I would love to hear next about Dr. Baker's experience talking with patients about some of these issues. Dr. Baker?
Sure. I think the first caveat that Dr. Bloom brought up was the fact that although these results are clearly provocative, they're currently based on small numbers of patients. And even to get these studies with small numbers of patients was a tremendous effort, and these studies are very costly to do. And so all investigators are certainly to be applauded for the efforts. But compared to the type of information we have to guide patients with other issues such as smoking or the effects of obesity on IVF success and pregnancy outcome, this is still would be classified as preliminary information. Another challenge we have in working with patients, and this has come up just in practical terms, people read about these things and they wonder, well, what is my BPA exposure? Do I have any idea? And unfortunately, this assay is not clinically available, so we can't really help give patients any feedback about their current exposures. However, despite some of those limitations, I think it is reasonable at this point in time to suggest to couples to avoid exposure to BPA containing sports water bottles and toys. And as we're probably all aware, due to some of the data that have been previously published, many companies now are getting BPA out of, for example, sports water bottles and toys. And so but that seems like a reasonable approach. I think it's also reasonable that we suggest to patients that they use glass instead of plastic containers, and sometimes particularly the old plastic containers that they're BPA containing, they're all scratched up, and rather than even just take a chance that there may be exposure, it's reasonable to use glass rather than plastic whenever possible. minimizing exposure to canned foods because of the resins that can be contained in the lining of these cans. It's not a bad thing to do, even just from a general health perspective, to eat more fresh foods and perhaps frozen foods, and so working to minimize that type of exposure. Issues related to dental sealants with the initial exposure that they provide are just something to talk about with a dentist if someone's about to undergo dental procedures. It seems reasonable to say I'd like to try to avoid my exposure to BPA and to at least put that into the decision making at that time. So yes, the bottom line is that I can't say for sure that this will end up meaning that there's a real concern about exposure to BPA, but I think there are enough data out there now for us to at this point have some concern and very little reason not to try to minimize exposure. I don't want to stress patients out though, because sometimes, you know, especially when you see things like, well, this can be in the air, dust, and water, which is true, kind of worry, like, well, you know, almost get paranoid and worrying about what things that you can't control. But I think controlling the things we can control is a reasonable approach.
Yeah, yes, I agree, and it is a fine balance between causing panic and educating patients to reduce their risk when they can. So thank you for your insight.
And very often it happens that we don't understand why either a couple is just not able to have a pregnancy on their own, or whether they are having miscarriages, or why their IVF cycles aren't working, or why their embryo quality doesn't look good. And when we get results back that we can't otherwise explain, it seems appropriate and reasonable to bring up issues. And I typically categorize this as something I don't know for sure, but I think it's reasonable to minimize your exposures as much as you can.
That's great. And while we're talking about that, the way you present it to patients, I'm wondering how they generally receive the information.
Overall, I think it's very well received. For some people, because there are organizations like yours that are getting the information out, it's not news. And some of them have already made some of these changes without me even mentioning it. For other people, it is the first time they've heard about it, and they pretty much just tend to nod in agreement and think, well, I might as well. What do I have to lose?
This is Vic Fujimoto, and can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And one of the issues that has come up, and I do talk about it with my patients now as they're preparing for IVF as a routine, but unfortunately, we don't have an assay that's clinically available that allows us to measure BPA that has yet to be validated from the standpoint of the outcomes we've talked about. And so not having that tool available, all we can recommend is modification. One of the questions I often get is, well, when do we modify, and how, you know, what's the window of exposure that is critical to minimize the effect of BPA on egg quality and on sperm quality? And the answer is we don't know.
Right.
The answer is these preliminary studies we've done thus far represent sampling that occurs at the time of the egg retrieval. And so we don't know whether a direct exposure to BPA around that time is solely responsible for the effects that we're seeing, or whether it's a much more of a larger exposure period that is that leads to the effects that we're seeing. And one of the things that we need to do moving forward is to define and critically assess what that exposure period is, because it's one thing to caution patients about avoiding BPA, not an easy thing to do in general because of its ubiquitous nature, but when do you tell them to avoid BPA, and when is it relevant and when is it not? Those are the part of the that we've incorporated those questions into moving forward with the further study of BPA and IVF, and those are going to be important questions that need to be answered moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that often the patients will want more details than we're able to give them. But I'm glad to hear that there's a beginning to be a conversation on reducing environmental exposures like BPA in vitro fertilization and in prenatal care moving forward. So thank you very much for presenting all of that useful information. And I think at this point it would be great to open up the call to some questions and further discussion. Erica, I think you have some instructions for the group.
Yeah, just one second, and I'll switch us into Q&A mode so that questions can be asked. Okay, so thank you for waiting again. I just need to remind everyone that if you wish to make a comment or ask a question at this time, you will first need to unmute your line by pressing the star key and then the number 6. So star 6 will unmute you. Please identify yourself before your comment, and if you could keep your remarks brief so that we have time to get to as many questions and comments as possible, that would be great. Also, when you are done, if you could press star 6 again to remute yourself, that helps us to keep excess noise down on the line as others speak. Thanks.
Hi, I have a question.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, this is Barb Calora, and I'm the Executive Director of Resolve, the National Infertility Association. So thank you very much, Karen and the speakers, for a really fascinating talk. And I do appreciate the way the conversation ended, which was in very practical terms, which is what we do at Resolve every day, is we are talking to people who have been diagnosed with infertility and want answers. And one of the things that we do at Resolve is we advise them on questions to ask their doctors and how to frame these sorts of conversations. So one takeaway that I'm wondering about, is it appropriate at this time for Resolve to put together a questions to ask for infertility patients that they could turn around and ask their doctor about? So that's my first question. And my second question is really to all of you, do your colleagues around the country, would they know the answers to the questions? You all are researchers. You do this this type of work, but many of your colleagues are perhaps not as up on BPA. So those are my two questions, and I would very much like some advice in this area.
Good question. Thank you. Would anyone like to venture an answer there?
Go ahead,
Vic.
No, you can start it.
Well, what I was going to say is that I think it would be very difficult for physicians to give clear answers to patients if they were asking questions about BPA exposure, not because they weren't interested or didn't think it mattered, but because of the preliminary nature of this data. And I think that one of the things in an organization like Resolve, if you're, even though today the focus of, we have a whole hour to talk about BPA, in a real-life consultation with a physician and a patient, we have a whole hour perhaps, or some places 45 minutes or whatever, we have dozens and dozens and dozens of issues to cover. And the question is, how do we prioritize that time? And it's not that this isn't very important, but I think in terms of it being like a routine, like if a patient came in and they had 45 questions and, four of them were on BPA, I'm not sure that it would be the best use of our time to use that. I mean, and I don't, you can't go into today the breadth of the types of questions patients will come in with, but I don't think we're so sure that this is the answer for a lot of people that it would be necessarily a focus. Now, that doesn't take away from the point that it would be, I think, useful just in terms of general patient education to get the word out that, it's reasonable to minimize your exposure as much as you can, because we just don't know now, and there's very little risk to trying to minimize your exposure.
Yeah, I think that's everything that Dr. Baker has just mentioned, I concur with. I think there's a couple things. One, there's public education. There's consumer education, which is how do we get information out to our patients who are planning or undertaking fertility treatments so that they understand the potential impact of BPA. And then there's a separate question, which is how do we educate our physicians and so that they have so that they are able to deliver the messages that need to be delivered. ASRM has established a special interest group on environment and reproduction. ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, is our national organization that whose focus is really to educate and organize infertility physicians in this country. And as a result of this special interest group, there will be increasing numbers of postgraduate courses that ASRM will be offering on environment and reproduction. And you know, I do think it's preliminary and premature, and while our findings, especially with respect to the egg, seem significant in terms of the impact, these data are really preliminary. And more importantly, this is really the first evidence in any of that any environmental contaminant, let alone BPA, is potentially adversely affecting human eggs. So, you know, up until this study, there wasn't even a connection for anything other than perhaps cigarette smoking. But cigarette smoking is an active, that's a behavior that is active versus the unintended exposures that we're talking about, such as BPA and other chemicals. So this is, you know, so I think this is the beginning of what we need to do in order to move this field forward, and clearly many more studies are needed, and we need to begin to educate the public and begin to educate our physicians. The strategy by which that happens it remains to be defined. I think Resolve can definitely play a role in that, but I think at the same time, you know, I think it's something that should be discussed on a national level with a number of different organizations.
Very good. Yes, and I find it very encouraging to hear that ASRM is working on encouraging postgraduate courses in environmental health.
Right. So, yeah, I'm the chair currently of the special interest group, and I can tell you that, you know, we are planning to organize in the next several years, several postgraduate courses that will address it. And, you know, this material that came out in December that Dr. Bloom and I published, you know, it's not been really demonstrated up until today on a national stage. So we want to do that within the context of ASRM as well, so that those physicians who are in the trenches are educated about what we think is happening.
Excellent.
One more thing is that we you know, a BPA is an endocrine disruptor that in the literature seems to be operating through the estrogen receptor. And if that is in fact the mechanism by which bisphenol A is altering the quality of eggs, then one has to begin to ask a even broader question, which is what other environmental chemicals that also are endocrine disruptors acting via the estrogen receptor, how many of these chemicals are potentially affecting egg quality and sperm quality, and if there are multiple chemicals that are potentially affecting egg quality and sperm quality, are they additive?
Sure, a cumulative effect of different
chemicals. Is there a cumulative effect of those exposures? Obviously, we don't know any of those answers, and this is the beginning, and this is the reason why that we need to make the effort to appeal to the National Institutes of Health and other funding organizations as to conducting these studies and answering these questions, because the effect could be far more profound than we currently think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that gives us a lot to think about.
But they are, in fact, and everything we've talked about, it are potentially modifiable variables.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, thank you for your question, Barbara. And is there someone else on the line who'd like to ask a question?
Hi, it's Corey. Karen, can you hear me?
Hi, Corey. Yes, I can
hear you. Hi. I think I just unmuted myself, and I was muted.
Oh.
Doctor, I do have a question for you. Apropos to what you were just saying, I'm with the American Fertility Association, and we've been counseling patients and pregnant women about environmental toxins for a number of years. As a matter of fact, Karen Russ, Ken Mosesian, and myself spoke to undergraduates yesterday at the University of Maryland's Baltimore campus. My question is this. Should we be isolating BPA from other phthalates, lead, toluene, the toxic trio, et cetera, when we speak to women about this? We have not been doing that. We've really been clustering all of the environmental toxins together, although we do try to give men and women regional information about the toxins which will be most applicable to their particular situation. Is that an error in our counseling? We've been doing it a number of years, but I'm not quite sure. Maybe we're missing the mark here.
I don't know that I'll speak, this is Dr. Fujimoto, on that. I don't know if that's necessarily an error. What I would say is that, you know, right now, we have preliminary data, and that preliminary data is accusing BPA as being a potential disruptor of egg development. One of the things that I think it's important is, yes, there are many other xenoestrogens that act through as endocrine disruptors, but not all. But it may not be the case that all of these xenoestrogens.
I feel your pain, doctor. You sound the way I did a week ago.
It may not be that all of these xenoestrogens are acting on the right estrogen receptor, and the effect, you know, whether they're actually antagonizing the receptor or in what way they're modifying the, you know, the effect. It's just not clear to us.
Okay.
So I don't want to, at this point, I think it's definitely premature to lump everything into one group. All we have evidence for right now is BPA.
Got it.
And I think we have to accept that scientifically we are very naive and have miles to go. But that said, you know, I think this is the first evidence, and I'll say this again, that potentially environmental contaminants and chemicals might actually be playing a much more important role in human reproduction than we ever imagined them to.
One thing that I do think is important for all of the patient advocates to be aware of is that even though BPA has been outlawed in this country, particularly in the manufacturing of baby bottles, many people do use old baby bottles. So we always do tell women who are trying to conceive to throw out old bottles if they're not breastfeeding. And
Has it been outlawed?
No, and we want to be clear about that. It hasn't been outlawed in general. I mean, and there's still many sources of BPA. It's not illegal to have BPA in the lining of a can.
But wasn't the legislation, I could be wrong, I thought legislation was passed eliminating it in baby bottles in the United States.
Actually, if you don't mind, I'll speak on that because I've been involved on the state level with some BPA legislation. Currently, there's 8 states in the U.S. that have outlawed BPA in baby bottles.
Okay.
There's another 2 that have eliminated BPA in children's food packaging. I'm located in the state of Maryland, and there's currently a bill before the state legislature to also ban BPA in children's food products. But as with any legislation, there's a lot of pushback from industry. They want to change their practices and get rid of their current inventory in another way.
But
so it's not outlawed across the board, no.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked that.
But
aware of that.
But again, that legislation occurred because there was concern about BPA and childhood exposures,
mm-hmm.
you know, and infant exposures. That has nothing to do with adult exposure. You know, there is nothing that has been done to limit adult exposures.
Right.
That's a very good point.
Well,
yes. Well, thank you for asking the question, Corey. And I think while BPA has the strongest evidence for affecting infertility treatments, fertility in general, some of the other chemicals you mentioned, like phthalates and toluene, have other reproductive effects in gestation. So we can, I think it's good to counsel patients to avoid those chemicals as well, but it's at a different point in their journey. So, very good. We just have a few moments left. I wonder if there are any other people on the call who would like to chime in, or I do have a question on the blog line as well. I will take a question from the call first. Okay, and then I'll go ahead and read. We have a question from Allie Carlson, and it's directed towards Dr. Baker. She's asking about when you counsel patients, and you had listed a variety of ways they can avoid BPA exposure, and Ms. Carlson is wondering about BPA in consumer receipts, in cash register receipts, and the dermal absorption of BPA when touching the receipts or when touching cash. I think it's also been found on dollar bills. So do you have any thoughts on that?
So as Dr. Fujimoto mentioned, that has been thought to be another source of BPA. Unless we all go to 100% credit cards, mm-hmm. it's a little bit difficult to avoid any exposure to cash. I would think that the people who would be at most risk would be the people who are in types of occupations where they handle more than an occasional receipt. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have something to add to that, Vic, about trying to minimize exposure to thermal receipts. But you know, most people, unless they're working in a service industry where they're with customers, would have a more limited number. And I haven't seen anything that directly correlated the level of exposure, because the biggest exposure we worry about is at least it's controllable, is probably at this point dietary. Do you have anything to add, Vic?
Not really. I mean, I think, as best as we can tell, everything is cumulative. The exposures, BPA, are cumulative. So thermal receipts probably contribute at some level. I think one of the big questions with thermal receipts right now among BPA scientists is, to what extent is BPA being absorbed through the skin versus secondary contamination of BPA by touching your fingers after you've handled the receipt and touching something that you eat or whatever. So, you know, is there direct contamination by BPA through the skin, or is it secondary through, through dietary after handling a receipt? And I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that yet. I know that this is a hot topic amongst BPA scientists now, and you know, I think we need to understand more about how BPA is getting into the system via these unique exposure risks.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah. Well, I see there is a lot of research that needs to be done, but I'm very grateful to hear about the findings that you have made, and also to hear Dr. Baker's take on translating that research into practice. So
yeah.
I'd like to thank the speakers once again for presenting on today's call, and also the participants for calling in and asking some wonderful questions. I would like to remind the group that we will have an MP3 recording of this conversation on the CHE Fertility website in about the next 24 hours, and then there may be other resources posted on the call page, articles and things to connect to if you're interested in more information. So thanks to everyone once again, and I hope to hear from you on the next CHE Fertility call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for the invitation.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.